Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one on your touch-tone phone to ask a question. I'd also like to remind parties this call is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I'd now like to turn the call over to Mr. Jim Schwendinger. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you, Jane. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in for today's COCA conference call. It's very exciting. We have two very, very experienced emergency preparedness response subject matter experts here from the CDC who are going to talk about CDC's activities in the preparedness and response arena. Our two speakers are very experienced, as I mentioned. I've had the pleasure of working with both of them for a number of years here in activities related to the Emergency Operations Center, and they're just amazingly skilled and experienced and knowledgeable as far as the process and the in-the-weeds, so to speak, implementation of our CDC mission of protecting the public health. First off, I'd like to introduce David DeSantis. He is my center in the National Center for Health Marketing here at CDC, my center emergency coordinator. Prior to that, he began his career with the United States Army and was in the military for 15 years in logistics. And it shows because he's a very organized and go-to kind of guy who gets things done when we need it done. He then went from the military to the Department of Defense and worked as a computer specialist for 18 years. He then came over to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention as a systems engineer and was later promoted to the lead technology officer in the Division of Emergency Operations within the CDC Emergency Operations Center. And most recently, as I just mentioned, he's moved over to my center where he is very valued as our emergency coordinator for the center. So without further ado, I will turn the call over to Mr. DeSantis.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's an honor and a privilege to have this time to speak to everyone. What we wanted to do is just take a minute of your time and kind of give you an overview of the CDC preparedness and response activities. A lot of questions have come in the past in reference to how does the CDC respond to different types of public health emergencies. One of the important things to note in that is that, you know, where does this authority come from to do to declare a public health emergency? And that comes either from the President of the United States or the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And what that means or described is as like this. The Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security Services has the authority to declare a public health emergency under Section 319 of the Public Health Service Act. A declaration is limited to a 90-day time frame after which the declaration expires. Declarations may be extended by the Secretary. A public health emergency may be declared if the Secretary determines, after consultation with such public health officials as may be necessary, that 1, a disaster or disorder presents a public health emergency, or 2, a public health emergency including significant outbreaks of infectious diseases and bioterrorist attacks otherwise exist. The declaration of a public health emergency facilitates funding and mobilization of resources to respond to the emergency. Following the declaration of a public health emergency, the Secretary may do one of a few things. He may make grants, enter into contracts, and support investigations into cause, treatment, or prevention of the disease or disorder. Also, make temporary up to 1 year or the duration of the emergency, 1 year appointments of personnel to positions that directly respond to the public health emergency. Also, authorize the emergency use of investigational products under Section 564 of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And finally, access no-year funds appropriated to the Public Health Emergency Fund. I wanted to give that overview just so that you have understanding how when a public health emergency has been declared and the CDC starts to get involved. Now, I was going to do the presentation, the remaining of this presentation, but now that I've moved to the National Center for Health Marketing, I felt it imperative that we have what I consider is one of the top subject matter experts on how the CDC responds, and that is Thomas Reynolds. Now, Tom is the team lead for the CDC plans, training, exercise, and information operations for the CDC Emergency Operations Center. He is a subject matter expert on emergency management, incident command system, the National Response Plan, the National Incident Management System, and emergency operations, having served on numerous national level committees for the rewrite and revision of these documents. Mr. Reynolds' resume includes 21 years as an Army civilian in the special weapons arena and radiological nuclear emergency response teams, and 7 years with FEMA as a response specialist dealing with nuclear power plant, community preparedness, and inspection. He was also the operations section chief for FEMA Region 4 during activation for a national disaster. Mr. Reynolds currently has 3 years at CDC and is the lead ERF emergency response for Director's Emergency Operations Center here at the CDC. Planning, training, and exercise at CDC responder capability using all hazards approach in the incident command system. He was also a 20-year volunteer firefighter and line officer in upstate New York. As you can see, Mr. Reynolds is very well-versed in all of this information, and I'm honored to have him, and I appreciate his attendance in this, and I will turn that over to Tom.
Thank you, David, and welcome to the presentation this afternoon. I am honored to do this presentation. If you bring your slides up to the front slide, as you can see on the slide, there are six things listed on there that COTPER and CDC, COTPER is the Coordinating Office of Terrorism Preparedness and Emergency Response, that CDC deems necessary as a goal for our preparedness for the agency. If you go onto our website at cdc.gov, you can look at these goals and understand what we mean about each of these goals. I don't want to go at length into these goals on your slide. So if you go to the next slide. During my presentation, we're going to talk about our CDC preparedness and response activities. We'll give you a brief description of the basis of authorities for CDC response, what CDC's current management structure is like, and our field management structure also, because I think that's important to you as clinicians. We'll also give you an overview of our deployment processes and supporting incident management structure. Next slide. This is a picture of our state-of-the-art, two-year-old emergency operations center. As you can see, there are 66 seats on the main floor of the DEOC. We affectionately call it the DEOC. It's the Director's Emergency Operations Center. And we use our operations center for our subject matter experts across the agency, across CDC, anywhere from the scientific aspect, ethics, DOD liaisons, our SMOs or our state management officials that we have out in the field that most of you or some of you are aware of. We man these desks when needed. They don't all necessarily have to be filled during an event, but on a day-to-day basis, it pretty much looks like this. What you don't see on the right-hand side of the screen is our watch staff. When you call into the CDC number at the top, the 7100 number, you get our watch staff, 24/7, 365. They're always there to answer calls and answer questions from clinicians. Next slide. This sort of gives you an idea of how CDC is laid out. As you know, Dr. Gerberding is the director for CDC, and where we are in the Coordinating Office of Terrorism Preparedness and Emergency Response as a direct report to the CDC director. She is intimately involved in every event that CDC has during the year, anywhere from the E. coli events to whatever circumstances are out there. We recently sent a couple of people to Ghana to deal with some issues over there, and she's well aware. She likes to know where her people are and where they're going. Next slide. Within my division, Division Emergency Operations, you can see how we're set up. We have a division director, a chief health and science officer that inputs scientific aspects into emergency operations. That's a little bit different than the normal, everyday variety emergency operations center. We need a scientist that can take the data that's coming in from the field and analyze it for us as emergency managers and how it relates to the scientific field. Down below, you can see the four sections that we have. DBS is our business services. We have an operations section, a log section, and myself is plans, training, information, and exercise. Next slide. Here are our preparedness goals, and I showed you some of them at the front. I'm not going to go through each of these, but there are 9 for us. Where we mostly get involved in is in the control, decrease the time needed to provide countermeasures and health guidance to those affected by the threats to the public's health. That is our entire goal here in the emergency operations section. Some of the guiding references, and some of you may or may not be aware of the national level guidance that's out there, is HSPD-5, Homeland Security Presidential Directive 5 and 8, that established a mechanism for the United States to prevent and respond to not only terrorism attacks, but major disasters and all hazards, which is what we're all about also. The basic premise and the base plan for that response is a national response plan. It's an all-discipline, all-hazards plan that really gets the federal agencies together in a common framework for the good of the response to the state. And then we all are using, of course, the National Incident Management System, and that's the common language, this common communications aspect of how to do incident command and incident management. Next slide. Here are some more, and you may or may not have seen these target capabilities. These are essential capabilities that all states and locals and feds should have, and you can read through those if you go to nimsonline.gov, and you can look at all of these. The Universal Task List is a menu of tasks that the federal government thinks that you should be able to perform during mitigation preparedness and response. The 15 national planning scenarios is really what the nation is planning around currently, and the planning scenarios are also listed at nimsonline.gov, and you can see what those are. Some examples are smallpox, earthquake, hurricane, nuclear detonation, 10K nuke debt is one of the 15 planning scenarios. And the next one down, the national preparedness goals, is what the nation's goal is for preparedness, and you can read that. Underneath all of that, we have our CDC emergency operations plan with approximately 8 annexes and about 20 appendices that deal with each of the specific agents or hazards that the nation has to deal with. Next slide. The National Response Plan, of course, is the guiding principle for domestic incidents. It doesn't come into play for international incidents, but it's an all-discipline, all-hazards plan. It gives us a common framework to work through for the management of domestic incidents with the states and locals, territorial and tribals. It also provides a structure for the federal response and the federal support, and it consists of the same thing as the CDC plan, a base plan, support annexes, and then incident-specific annexes against the national planning scenario. Next slide. NIMS is not a new term to you all out in the field. It's a consistent nationwide approach for incident management. The fire service has used it since the mid to late 70s. It's a way that everybody can talk the same lingo in the field for incident management. And it requires that the feds, the state, local, territorial, and tribal, and local governments work together before, during, and after. It's just not during the event. You have to plan, then you have to respond, and then you have to recover. It involves preparing for and preventing all of those domestic incidents. And, of course, law enforcement gets involved in that. And it doesn't matter. NIMS can be used no matter what the size of the event, whether it's a small forest fire like, well, it's not small anymore, but the one that we have here in South Georgia, but, you know, it could be a local incident of a chem spill or whatever. It can be used for any incident, no matter what the size or complexity. But the important thing is that an incident commander is an incident commander, whether it's at the local level or the fire chief that's on the ground, or it's here at CDC, where the incident commander is commanding the resources that CDC has. We don't command, really, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. We look at it as a management of resources. Next slide. The National Response Plan shows 15 emergency support functions, and we are part of both 6 and 8. Our main lead is the Department of Health and Human Services under Public Health and Medical Services, and then we get involved in Mass Care, Housing, and Human Services. That's one of our missions that we have recently picked up under the ongoing rewrite of the new National Response Plan that isn't out yet. Next slide. We as a primary agency, Department of Health and Human Services, are to coordinate federal assistance to the states and locals for public health and medical needs in, following a disaster emergency. As you can see below, we use a lot of other federal agencies to help us provide that support. If we need nurses and docs, we reach into DOD, we reach into the VA to get those assets to put in the field for an effective public health response. Next slide. Here are some of our overall ESF 8 responsibilities, and I use that term as CDC in conjunction with HHS and the other OPTIS that work under CDC and HHS. But you can see that a large number of these are critical CDC missions. Take, for example, public health surveillance. We are the nationally known and internationally known premier organization for public health surveillance. And we can do a laundry list of things under that premise. We deal with food safety to a small degree. We work with the USDA and the FDA for events such as E. coli and those other things. We have a NIOSH unit that works with the Office of Health and Safety for CDC that deals with mask issues, PPE, those types of things. Vector control we're known for mosquito spraying, control and those types of things. You can look down through there and pretty much pick out what CDC is mainly responsible for, but all of these missions are ESF 8 missions. Next slide. We like to use director's critical information requirements. These are the things that we would get Dr. Gerberding up at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, hey, we got this going on. You need to know about this. What do you want us to do? Do you want us to activate the operations center and call in all of our resources or whatever? But these are the things that we look at on a regular basis that is very important to this agency and to HHS as a whole and to the federal government. So if one of these things happens, we're calling her. Doesn't matter what the time of day or night it is. Or if she's even overseas. She has a sat phone on her all the time where we can get her 24/7, 365. Next slide. This is really the most important slide here for clinicians. One of the things that we do, and you can see on the left-hand side there, about 3 down from the left, is where the clinician comes into play. The most important thing that I want to tell you today is that when you call 7100, the number that for the CDC DEOC, more than likely they're going to refer you back to the state because that's where you have to deal with it from a clinician's aspect on a regular daily basis. They will refer you back to your Department of Health. If it is other than on-duty hours, then we can refer you to our SMEs or our subject matter experts. Some of the things in the majority of our calls to our hotline from clinicians, and I just got this off of our watch staff today, was the three big ticket items that they always get called for: botulism cases, malaria suspected cases, and rabies. Those are the things that keep coming up over and over and over again every day and every shift, it seems like. Most of those will refer back to the state. Like I said, we do have subject matter experts on call 24/7 that if a doctor with a patient needs to have advice in the off hours, we will connect them to an SME who will connect them to each other so that they can talk about the particulars of that particular case and try to come to a resolution. But the DEOC is just a conduit. We have protocols in place when we receive a call for a consult on a malaria that we would call our subject matter expert and put them in contact with that clinician. However, I do want to emphasize that 90% of the time, we're going to refer you back to the state health department because that is your main resource. Next slide. This is CDC's response in conjunction with the HHS response, and then way over on the left-hand side, you can see the Department of Homeland Security advisory system. We use all three in our response. Our everyday mode that we use is our watch mode, where we have at least two watch staff and a duty officer on duty 18 hours a day, and then two watch staff overnight. And that's our normal monitoring mode. We look across the country and across the world for anything that pops up. We've got 18 TV screens here that they're monitoring 24/7 for anything that could possibly pop, and that's our normal everyday duty watch mode. When we get into some things that are starting to happen, i.e. we get a notification of a possible E. coli event or something dealing with lettuce or spinach or something, then we start moving into a phase that we call alert. And that's where we start getting involvement from our subject matter experts out in the coordinating offices and centers here at CDC. We do a mission analysis review of what they know about the disease and what we should be doing. And then if it's a bigger case, then we start talking to our federal and state counterparts on future planning and future deployment for epi-AIDS or whatever the case may be. If we need to and they need additional resources from the centers, we can call in those resources and start the deployments. That's when the center goes to a full alert mode, and you'll see it in the next slide here of how we phase those responses. Usually the last one, the full-out response mode, is for a catastrophic incident of some type, such as Katrina. We do incident planning in accordance with the ICS components. We use a lot of resources to gather our intelligence and report information, and you out in the field are paramount in our information gathering. We have to rely on the data that you are giving CDC in order to effectively respond to state and local requests. We'll talk about the SMO there on the bottom shortly. We'll go through what he does for the states that have an SMO on the state. Next slide. Here you can see our alert to response mode. Our everyday normal watch is tier zero. When we start moving in and the center can't control it, that deals with that issue, say it's botulism, and they can't control it within the center with the few people that they have, or they start working across the agency with other subject matter experts in other centers, then we would ask them to bring it into the DEOC so that we can give them the resources that they need to respond. Something like E. coli was a tier one response where we had 25 to 30 people in the DEOC 24/7 working the issues other than on the weekends. And mainly that was because the laboratories didn't always work 24/7 out in the state and local. But, you know, if it were a bigger event, of course, we would ask them to open up and work the issue. As we move into a bigger response, a good example was the start of SARS. That moved into 100 people really quickly. And we started looking at SARS, and then it finally grew to over 200 and some people at CDC for involvement across multiple centers. And that would be a full Tier 3 response or a catastrophic response. Next slide. This chart is very busy, but I just wanted to show it to you because as we're starting into the hurricane season, how we deal with HHS and DHS and how they look at landfall and pre-phases and stages and tiers, it's too complicated, but it sort of gives you a look at that we're tying into the rest of the federal agencies of how they're responding, so we meld into the federal government response as a CDC response. Next slide. Most of you already know ICS, and this is the basic structure. The incident commander at the top with his command staff for safety PIO and liaisons, and then the FLOP down on the bottom, operations, planning, logistics, finance, and admin. Next slide. Some of the challenges that we have here at CDC in particular are stabilizing our management structure, because we have so many centers here that deal with different types of issues. We have, you know, the Center for Environmental Health. We've got the Center for Infectious Disease, and they all deal with different things. So the management structure has to change from event to event to event. So we sometimes struggle with stabilizing that management structure, but we're working through those issues. The core elements for the response always are the same. You always have the FLOP. You always have the command staff. You always have the general staff underneath. One of the things that we use, and I'll show you in a slide here in a second, is the CDC system for response. And one of the most important things in the planning cell is what we call the technical specialty unit. That is where all of our scientists fit in to what CDC does to respond to an event. Reporting hierarchy, as with any federal agency, we have to report to everybody. And what we call the big green monster out there for wanting information is constant for us to try to get and try to feed. Personnel accountability. For Katrina, we deployed over 600 people out in the field, so that was a difficulty for us trying to keep control of where they were at, who they were with, when they were coming home, how they were getting home. So you can imagine when you deploy that many people to the field, the problems that you would encounter. And then refining and exercising the plans. That's a continuing cycle. You have to write the plans, then you have to train to those plans, and then you have to exercise those plans to see if the plan is valid. And if it's not, then you have to go through an after-action process to revise the plan and start the cycle all over again. Next slide. I told you a little bit about that. I want to talk a little about command and management and what the difference is. What we look at here at CDC is the incident commander is the person that's on the ground dealing with the incident. CDC isn't ever there. We're not going to be there. We're not going to be the incident commander. It's always going to be the state and locals that are dealing with the situation on the ground. So we look at our piece as incident management. We are managing CDC resources that we would send to respond to that incident. We use most of ours is to provide technical assistance through our subject matter experts, either to the incident commander on the scene or to the incident management team here at CDC. We don't have any direct authority over your field resources, but we do provide resources as requested through the normal mechanisms that we'll talk about here shortly to the field and through the federal system. Next slide. This just shows that everyday normal duty business is done within the coordinating centers. When it's a small event, they handle that event within their offices. When it gets overwhelming and they start using multiple centers or need additional resources, that's when they mold into the technical specialty unit and we activate the full incident command system. Next slide. This sort of gives you a little idea about, how we're doing pandemic influenza in the WHO phases, WHO phases. In 0 to 2, you know, most of it is being done in the coordinating centers and coordinating by our chief health officer and providing guidance to the country, to the nation, to the international teams that are out there and providing those resources. When we get into WHO phase 3, some of that responsibility shifts into a response mode and we go into an incident management. As soon as we get notification of a suspected case of PI in the United States, then we'll be in incident management mode and then we'll bring everybody in and start working the issue. But as you look at the bottom there, accountability still remains within the centers because that's where the expertise is. Next slide. Very busy slide. Just for your edification so that you can look and see how we're structured. We're structured a little bit different than, you know, most federal agencies or most state and local agencies because we have subject matter experts. But if you look in the center of your screen where it says Tech Specialty Unit in red, that is our scientific component, and that is what we need to have in order to effectively respond. We bring in those people, the EPIs, the environmental health folks, the red nuke specialists, whomever we need that we have here in CDC to effectively respond. Next slide. This just gives you an idea of how we're set up, the operations section in the three branches. Next slide. Planning section, like I said, that tech specialty unit is our bread and butter. We do a documentation unit just like everybody else, incident action planning, after action reviews, and demobilization planning, and then we also have a situation awareness unit. Next slide. Log and finance. We kind of combine these two because we don't have a good breakout of how they respond. They respond effectively together because they have to deal with so many of the same issues. So they're separate, but they're in the same room talking to each other at the same time. Next slide. I wanted to put this slide in here for you to look at of how we respond during a national event. And if you look on the far left side, where you see the PFO, the principal federal official, and the joint field office, JFO, where do we fit into the scheme of things? And if you go up to where DHS is under ESF-8, the component for ESF-8 is Health and Human Services there. And then it goes down to CDC and the other OPTIS that are underneath HHS, and then down to the DOC, back up to the SOC, and then you can see our structure on the side. One of the things that we have that HHS has put out into the field is this IRCT concept, that is the Incident Response Coordination Team, that sits with DHS ESF-8 component and directs and controls the medical resources that are needed in the field. And they talk back and forth through the JFO to the states and to the locals on what are the health and medical needs out in the field. We'll talk about the senior management official and what they do here shortly. I've got a complete slide set for those. Next slide. So what are our potential CDC missions? Conduct public health needs assessments and environmental assessments. Provide vaccinations and medical supplies. We have the strategic national stockpile housed here at CDC. Conduct disease surveillance, our primary mission. And then provide mental health assessment and response and deploy the pharmaceutical and medical supplies that we have. Next slide. I just wanted to touch very briefly on the mission assignment process, and you can look through this slide, but really the request starts from the state. That's where the mission originally originates, and that's where it has to go. It has to go from the state to FEMA through the Joint Field Office before it gets assigned to one of the federal agencies. When it gets to DHS, then they look at it, see if it's a valid mission, and then assign it to their appropriate, what we call OPTIV, Operating Division, for the activation of that response. And that's how we get the mission assignment down through the process and the federal bureaucracy for that affected. But it takes a while. Sometimes it takes a day or two to go through this process. And I hate to say that, but we're getting better at doing prescripted mission assignments so we can get requests for assistance out to the states a lot faster. Next slide. This sort of gives you an idea of what our structure was, our federal structure was for the Texas response during Katrina and Rita. And you can look and see where ESF-8 is and then CDC ultimately on the bottom. Next slide. So what is the CDC emergency or senior management official and what is their role in emergency response? In the picture on the next slide, you can see one of our guys on the right-hand side, Steve Bodenheimer in the state of Arkansas. They are really the oversight of CDC resources in the state during an emergency. And they provide that technical public health CDC's assistance to the state during that emergency. Next slide. They also give us at CDC situational awareness of what's happening on the ground and in the state, so that we can more effectively respond to any requests. And they are our point of contact for the state and federal response to interact with all of the other federal agencies that are in that state or sitting in that state EOC. Next slide. Oversight of the CDC resources that we put into the field, we try to let the SMO manage those resources effectively, and they're responsible for those people, in addition to the incident response coordination team that is sent by HHS. And we want to assure that we're maximizing the coordination of and effective use of our teams. Next slide. You can see how the senior management official relates across the spectrum, back and forth to the state health department, the joint field office, the incident response coordination team, and then ultimately to the CDC field team. One of the things that, you know, sometimes we never know when to come home. So we struggle sometimes with when a CDC mission is over. To the average person that's out in the field, I want to get out of there within 2 to 3 weeks. So that's one of our roles is a rotation of our staff. And then containment or mitigation of the event, when the state actually resumes their roles and responsibilities or has the ability to do that, when the Secretary's Emergency Operations Center says go back to your normal operations, or when the RRCC, which is the Regional Response Coordination Center for the FEMA region that's out there, returns back to normal operations. That's when we think that our mission is over. Next slide. Let's skip this one and then go to additional resources. I put this in here because most of you should, if you get a chance to take these four courses, I would advise anybody that is responding to any event out in the field to take these four IS courses through the FEMA website. It's basic incident command, and 200 is a little bit more in-depth. The IS 700 course is how incident management system works and an introduction to that, and then the IS 800, which should be shortly revised, is the National Response Plan. Next slide. In addition, there's a lot of other things that you can look at. The states offer a lot of these courses, so if you're interested in further ICS training, go to your state health trainer, and maybe they can find those online for you. Next slide. I just want to remind everybody that the DEOC, or the Director's Emergency Operations Center, is operational 24/7, 365. We do use incident command. We do conduct incident management and information management so that we do have situational awareness and a common operating picture of what's going on as best we can. We have a complete logistics section that supports our CDC deployers no matter what the time of day, and we do have redundant communications. A lot of you already have communications with us through UHF radio. And each of our seats has a functional area action officer that can reach back into the organization to get the help that you need. The number at the bottom is very important. If you're a clinician and you've been referred to your state health director and they refer you back to CDC for further consultation, call that number. Our desk officers will triage the call and hook you up with the appropriate subject matter expert for that particular case. And next slide, if there's any questions right now. I did put a list of acronyms in there after the question slide because a lot of us in emergency management sometimes like to use weird acronyms that not everybody in the world knows. But I thank you for this opportunity, and we'll take some questions at your leisure, Jim.
Well, thank you very much, Tom and David. That was excellent. What we had tried to do, we had some feedback from our COCA audience that, you know, it really is kind of a mystery to the folks that aren't involved in any kind of emergency response. I mean, as Tom mentioned, you know, the history of ICS goes back to the fire service. But there's folks that just have never, you know, interacted with an emergency kind of situation in that way, and it is really kind of a mystery. So you've done a great job. Thank you for doing that, for, you know, shedding some light, hopefully. Jane, I'd like to actually open it up if there's any callers with questions. We have Tom and David here, and, you know, at your reserve to answer any questions you might have about the presentation.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. To withdraw your request, press star 2. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 now on your touch tone phone. Our first question comes from Larry Williams. Your line is open. Please state your organization.
This is Larry Williams at the Great Lakes Naval Health Clinic. My question is regarding legal advice. I've given a lot of presentations and talked to other groups, and you know the question about quarantine, isolation, and you know the state waffle. You know, I've heard people say, well, it's the CDC's call. No, it's the state's call. It's a local, you know, local group's call. Is there any legal consultation with the CDC that is able to advise and assist someone calling from the state that would be able to add that kind of information for them?
I'll actually answer that just because it's kind of out of the scope of this presentation. But, you know, briefly, legal consultation I think is a term we should not maybe use. But, I mean, the short answer is that, you know, if the state or, you know, the existing system in the local and state health department system is unable to answer, certainly CDC has, you know, we have an entire legal affairs office, a public health legal office actually as well. We actually had a COCA presentation by the quarantine staff a couple of months ago that answered some of this. I mean, briefly, you know, there is a line of authority as far as declaring a quarantine. CDC is involved in that. However, it typically comes from the federal government, from the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the President. So what I would actually like to do is that question, please, and any others that are involving really the legal aspects, if you could send them in an email, we can make sure that we answer them, you know, accurately, because I am not a subject matter expert on the legal authority quarantine, I'll say that. But we can, you know, certainly get your question directed to those individuals. So if you could email us at COCA, that's COCA, at CDC.gov, I will be sure to get that question, you know, to the legal quarantine subject matter experts for an answer. But that's an excellent question. Thank you for asking it.
Well, the thing that's come up before is, you know, when you look at your prevent, detect, investigate, control, recover, and improve, when you go to the investigate stage and then you start determining what actions need to be taken, it goes beyond the simple, you know, the medical side of it, you know, where a clinician's involved, and then, you know, this person needs to be detained because, or this incident, you know, this area needs to be quarantined because of the risk, at, you know, for the group. That's where I'm, and that, when you look at NIMS and ICS, the legal side of it, it's an adjunct, you know, it's a subject matter expert that's called in, and I do training for Incident Command and Unified Command, and that's one of the things that's sort of missing, is how to answer some of the legal questions that people are going to ask. You know, what authority do I have to do certain things? And it might be nice if that was in a little cookbook-type form when, you know, the EOC is stood up, just exactly what can we answer. And like you said, you know, it's nice to ask those questions now, but is there something out there that could be helpful, at, you know, when it hits the fan, so to speak?
Absolutely. This is Tom again. During our response and when we're in response mode and alert phase, we bring in our legal specialists into the DOC.
Good. Okay.
Those types of questions from the states and locals that you can get clarification of those answers. That's
okay.
Good.
So I just didn't see. I guess if the print was so fine, I couldn't make it out on the slides, so maybe they're in there somewhere and I just didn't see it.
We had to put an eye chart in there somewhere. You know?
Thanks.
You're welcome, sir.
Our next question comes from Chris Murky. Your line is open. Please state your organization.
Alliant Energy Corporation. And my question is a little bit off task in regards to pandemics, but could possibly be related. There was a smallpox vaccination that was given to a service member of the United States. I don't know if he was Army, Navy, Marines, or what he was. But he came home and he was playing with this 28-month-old baby boy on a 4-day leave, and the boy became infected and had a severe case. Can you speak to that, please?
I'm sorry, that's really beyond the scope of this call. I mean, we certainly are aware and we were involved in that case, you know, workup and management. Please email me that question and I can give you particulars. I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, evade the question. It's just, We got, you know, we really kind of put the word out about this call as talking about the you know, more high-level kind of response, and that's really kind of a specific case. But if you email us at coca@cdc.gov, I'll be happy to give you, you know, the background information that we have.
Thank you.
We have a question from Ann Arroyo. Your line is open. Please state your organization.
California Department of Health Services. Thank you. Do you have the written procedure or some description you can provide us that tells us how you transfer from the center to the alert to the response phase so we can make sure our plans match up?
Absolutely. We're going through the clearance process on our emergency operations plan, and that should take about another month, and then we can send it out to the states as soon as it's been vetted through CDC and HHS. I don't have it right in hand right now. It'll take about that month's time, but I'll make sure that Jim gets it to put on the COCA website.
Okay, along the same lines, we saw the duty statement, I think it was, for the SMOs, but will you have a little bit more definitive, similar description so we can also make sure that our plans and procedures match up?
Absolutely. I do have that, and I do have the statement of work for our SMOs out there in the field, and I will also have that posted to the COCA website.
Thank you.
Welcome,
Ed. We have a question from David Zane. Your line is open. Please state your organization.
Texas Department of State Health Services. My question pertains to the technical specialty unit. The individuals that staff that unit, are they physically in the DEOC or are they in their offices and are just patched in when issues arise?
Excellent question. As you can well imagine, what we try to use is action officers here in the DEOC because we don't have space. Some of our teams, what we call teams during a response, are 20, 30 people that work together as a cohesive unit to try to mitigate the event. We, for each of those boxes there, we have a space here in the DEOC that person is responsible for any actions for that particular action officer, whether it be EPI or surveillance or clinician care or whatever the case may be, they're responsible to take that and give that to the team that's working behind them. They reach into the organization, and the team that's behind them that may be working in their offices or in a conference room somewhere else in CDC campuses is support to the DEOC. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, sir.
And again, as a reminder, if you have a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Our next question comes from Dr. Karen Erstfeld. Your line is open. Please state your organization.
Yes. Hello, my name is Karen Erstfeld. I'm calling from the Department of Health and Senior Services from the state of New Jersey. My question involves the primary response functions of the SMOs. I was wondering, just like the previous questioner, would that include personnel resources to assist in the field, meaning team deployment if necessary?
Great question. Yes, they can coordinate some of that through the CDC DEOC and through the mission assignment process to the federal government, and that would work through the joint field office that FEMA would set up during the disaster. Their everyday function, though, for the senior management officials on the ground is to work with the Department of Health on a multitude of issues. Only during response do they roll into controlling CDC assets on the ground.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome.
We have a question from Diana Zam. Your line is open. Please state your organization. Diana Zim or Ann Arroyo, if you're on the line, please state your organization.
This is Ann Arroyo from California again. On the technical specialty unit, did you call it?
Yes, that's what we call our scientific planning component.
And I believe you just said that because of the size, they might actually be located slightly differently than in your DEOC. Are you including your laboratory experts in that group?
Absolutely. In the first block under the infectious disease team, it includes all of our laboratory network that is out there, the LRN response, and the tie-in to our CDC laboratories here is all-inclusive in the TSU.
And in the material that you might be posting, the procedures, plans and procedures you might be posting soon, will you also include a description of how that unit operates?
We can. We can give you what their roles and responsibilities are during our response in generics.
I'd love to see that.
Okay.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have no further questions from the phone lines at this time.
Well, great. I would just like to remind the listeners, thank you thank you first for participating. And, you know, if you didn't have a chance or you think of a question later, I know that I always think of five as soon as I hang up. You know, you can always email us at coke@cdc.gov. And we've already worked out with Mr. DeSantis and Mr. Reynolds that they will kindly answer the ones that are specific to the presentation today. Also remind you that the audio track of this conference will be on the web pretty shortly. We already have the slides there, and, you know, in a timely manner, we'll have a transcript posted. You know, again, email us at coke@cdc.gov, and we can get those answers for you. And I will turn it back over to Jane, who will talk about the replay number. But thank you again for participating, and please stay tuned for details of our next COCA conference call.
Thank you. And again, as a reminder, if you would like to listen to the replay of this call, the dial-in number is 866-483-9031. Again, that replay number, 866-483-9031. That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.